you. Thank you very much for the invitation. And I'm always happy to be back at Perimeter. So today I will be telling you about some recent developments that we've been working on. And the title that I have right now, it's pretty accurate, but I'm not going to explain it at this stage, okay? So we'll go through what these words mean as we move on. So let me just tell you what this is based on and highlight my collaborators. So we've been working on this for a few years, and there's two papers initially with Alex, Joao, and Christoph, and more recently, just a month ago, we continued this very beautifully with Alex, Christoph, and my PhD student, Beatrix, in Amsterdam. So okay, so what's going on? So we have ADS-CFT as this correspondence that relates a theory of gravity in empty de Sitter space with a conformal field theory without gravity in one dimension lower. Now, our understanding of this dictionary on how we relate the two sides of the duality imposes certain conditions on the conformal field theories such that you can have a semi-classical gravitational theory. Okay, so there's certain conditions that are well known, are well documented, about what are the requirements on the CFT such that the dual ADS theory has a semi-classical description. So what the basic question that I'm going to try to answer today is how do we go about building these conformal field theories that have these semi-classical features, okay? These gravitational features. So let me take the field theory perspective and say, how would I go about and characterizing, building, constructing, designing conformal field theories? How would I discover gravity if I start from the conformal field theory side, okay? So we know what the conditions are. It's basically, what is the set of theories that satisfy those conditions? Can we quantify the landscape of theories that actually satisfy and meet this criteria? Now, this is a challenging question for various reasons, as we're going to start seeing as we go along. And I'm going to start making some simplifications and making kind of going into smaller corners of this big question. And in particular, the first simplification that I'm going to make is that I'm going to go to the instance of holography of ADS-3 CFT2, okay? So it's a very specific number of dimensions. It's not universal, so many of the tools and strategies that I'm going to take in trying to understand the answer to this question of what makes a CFT have this semi-classical gravitational features is going to be kind of specific to the setup, but I think it illustrates the challenges about how do we go about answering this question and characterizing the space of conformal field theories, okay? So in this setup, so in this corner that I'm putting myself, the question kind of boils down a bit to the following. So on the ADS side, I want to be able to access, as I turn on couplings and things, I want this theory to have a supergravity description, okay? So this is my requirement. I want to have a semi-classical theory of gravity on this side of the duality, where it's a two-derivative theory, Einstein-Hilbert term plus negative cosmological constant, some matter around it, that's fine. But this is basically the type of theories of ADS that I'm interested in studying. On the conformal field theory side, the basic requirement by just saying that you want something that looks supergravity will force me to look in the space of conformal field theories as theories that have a very large central charge, okay? So the interest here is characterizing the space of conformal field theories at very, very large central charges. And the strategy that I'm going to take is the following. So I'm not going to be explicit. It's hiding in various parts of the talk, and if you ask me and interrogate me, it will become more explicit, but the inspiration for our work came from many known examples in string theory. I'm going to be exploiting holography. What do we know about the holographic principle and how the dictionary works? So that's going to be a very recurrent theme. And the new part that I'm not going to really give you any of the technical details, I will just tell you what it is because in 40 minutes, that will be impossible, and Astrid will be like, shut up now. It's one thing that I'm very excited about is the mathematics that we're using. We're using various elements of number theory, of the theory of modular forms, and this is actually the key for us to start answering this question very precisely and giving you a characterization of what are the space of conformal field theories. So very good. So how is this talk going to look like? Basically, in my ambitions, kind of like I'm going to tell you about everything, which usually does not happen in previous attempts to giving this talk, but it's basically going to be divided into three parts, okay? So I'll try to go through these three parts. So the first part is basically I'll give you my current definition of what makes a CFT holographic, meaning a CFT that if I take this large central charge limit, I will have the gravitational features that I expect from ADS CFT. Okay, and so for that, what we will do, we will go through what are the necessary conditions on the spectrum of the CFT, what am I asking for these conformal field theories, and then we'll set up the strategy on how would I solve for those conditions, okay? So this is going to be the biggest part of the talk. Most of the time, I'll be just trying to quantify for you, like, what do I mean here? Like, what are these conditions, and how do we go about trying to solve them in certain situations? Then the second part, this is where I should have talked a lot about mathematics, but I'm not, so I'm just going to present to you what the results are, okay? So given some choices that we're making, we can completely characterize that space of theory, so I'll give you basically a landscape of what are conformal field theories. There will be supersymmetric theories, but okay, we do what we can, and in this category, we can tell you basically okay, these are theories, these are candidate conformal field theories that satisfy your necessary conditions that you specified in the previous slide, okay? And new results, because this landscape was not quantified before, new results are basically in here. So we can tell you what will be new conformal field theories that have all the right ingredients for ADS CFT. And then the last part, this is the one that I might have to skip if I go too slowly through the other two, is basically how all this technology, the technology that we're applying on this modular form, teaches us about black hole entropy. And basically what I mean here by quantum is that I'm really going beyond the area law. So how from constructing these suitable examples of conformal field theories, they also predict not just the Bekenstein-Hawking area law, they also predict corrections for the Bekenstein-Hawking area law. They predict logarithmic corrections, they will predict power law corrections, and this is where you can start understanding, okay, what is happening, what are the microstates, what is the black hole kind of made out of, okay? So this is also a very beautiful part that I hope I have time to address. But very good, so let's start first. Okay, so we have this concept of holographic CFT. So first things first, okay, so what is ADS3 gravity? So this is literally what I have in mind. So we'll have the Einstein-Hilbert action, Ricci scalar, negative cosmological constant. I'll be using the words supergravity or gravity theory, doesn't matter, but basically I'm thinking that I have the gravitational part and you can have whatever, like some gauge fields, you can have some spinners, you can have some scalars, basically whatever like massless fields you want to have. Here, okay, pick your favorite. It won't matter for what I'm going to say. What's important is that I want to attain this basically semi-classical description. Now, if you just write this equation, there's many very beautiful universal features of this theory that we like. So for instance, there's perturbative states in this theory. They're basically, the ones that just come from this part are known as the boundary gravitons, the Baran-Hinault boundary states, those I will be calling perturbative states. There's also perturbative states coming from the matter. So the matter can wiggle, and those little wiggles I will be putting them into the category of perturbative states, okay? So you have like an ADS background and like fields propagating on top of it. Now, this theory as well contains the gravitational sector already tells you that there's black holes, it's the BTC black hole solution, and those states I will colloquially refer to them as heavy states. They're big, they're fat, they carry lots of entropy, okay? We love black holes. Now, depending on the matter, how did you came about this theory of ADS3 gravity, if you're in string theory, it will come from a higher dimensional construction, well, whatever made you come down to this like effective action, there could be other stuff depending on what precisely I write here. There can be like multicenter solutions, there can be conical defects, but this is not, like, if you have a precise example, then we can discuss this third point. But this will tend to not be universal. This is specific to what matter you have. And so as you try to refine the correspondence and understand the details of how things are matching on both sides, then this is important. But I'm trying to keep things broad, so I'm not going to focus on this.
Where do you use supersymmetry?
Here, I haven't used supersymmetry at all. So
you are going to.
I will let you know. It will be super, like, I hope it will be super clear when I use supersymmetry.
Okay.
Yeah. yeah, but at this stage, like, you can just ask this question, kind of, like, a supersymmetric theory will also share these features. Like, there's nothing here that I'm saying that is specific to, say, in supergravity or just gravity. Like, if you have this part in the action, then these words still all hold. And so one of the universal entries in the ADS3 CFT2 that I already advocated for was that there's a central charge here in the CFT. The Brown-Hinault central charge is 3 times the ADS radius in Planck units, three halves. And this is the number that, because you want to be large, the ADS radius, you want it to be large in Planck units, this value of C has to be very large if you want to attain this semi-classical description. Okay, so this is why I need C to be very big. Okay, so let's start building this holographic CFTs based on these gravitational properties that I said. So we will have basically two, roughly speaking, conditions. So I want my CFT to capture black holes, and I want my CFT to capture this perturbative regime. So on one side, okay, I have this black hole, this very heavy state. So I will never use this metric again, but it's always rewarding to write down the metric of a black hole because they're beautiful, they're so elegant. This is the BTC black hole. As higher dimensional counterparts, they carry entropy, they have a mass, they have an angular momentum. This is a very big number. If you make it supersymmetric, there's an additional U1 Chern-Simons field that you have to add to this. If you want like n equal 2 supersymmetry. And making this configuration supersymmetric basically implies a restriction between the mass and the angular momentum of the black hole, and it sets the temperature to 0. And yeah, and there's a quantization condition on the U1 charge. Okay, so this will be like your supersymmetric version of BTC. But in any case, this guy is big. I want to look at black holes that are large in Planck units. The statement in ADS CFT is that the black hole entropy should basically be the logarithm of the number of microstates at some given energy for a CFT characterized by a central charge C. And this is basically one of the first very successful results of ADS3 CFT2, is that you can make the entropy of the black hole agree with the asymptotic density of states of the CFT. And this result is basically just dictated by symmetry, roughly speaking. Okay, it's known as the Cardy limit. So there's more things. I could spend like 10 other minutes ranting about what it means to go from here to here. But roughly speaking, this is a result that is controlled by modular invariance. Okay, if you don't care too much about the details, but if you, there's a little bit more that I'll refer to when we get to the orange section. But in any case, so you want to basically have this, which is almost guaranteed. It's almost free. Now, in the perturbative part, so the perturbative part of the spectrum is not dictated by symmetry, okay? Modular transformations, conformal invariants, they're going to tell you how to organize the spectrum, but they're not going to put restrictions on what the spectrum is. It's not going to tell you what set of primaries you're allowed to have. Or not, okay? So the perturbative part will impose restrictions on what the CFT should be in order for it to match the gravitational features that I want. So from the gravitational point of view, I want to have the semi-classical description. I want to have a perturbative description. I don't want to overwhelm my theory of gravity with matter, so I want to have like a controllable amount of fields in this gravitational setting, okay? So that I can have this effective approach. And this, very beautiful, you can set what this restriction is just in terms of like, oh, how many fields can you have in ADS by just doing like curve, basically quantum field theory in a curved background. So you can estimate this is how much, if you do dimensional analysis, that will tell you how many fields you're allowed to do to have in this box that is ADS. But you can also phrase it very beautifully you can relate it to the black hole physics as well. So one characteristic feature of ADS3 or ADS gravity in general is that there's a Hawking page transition. Okay, so there's a temperature up to which the black hole dominates the free energy of the system. And requiring the presence of this phase transition actually puts restrictions on the perturbative spectrum. You can't have too many fields, too many light fields, if you want the phase transition to exist. If there's too many light fields, then you just have a continuous kind of transition between one regime to the other. If you want a sharp, like actually an actual phase transition, then you need to have very light number of fields. You can also phrase this in the context of supersymmetric black holes. But the punchline is that what I'm looking from in the point of view of the CFT, I will look like that the number of states at this low energies for this perturbative part of the spectrum grows at most as power law, where the power here is strictly less than one. Okay? So this will be a requirement. So this is not the entropy of the black hole. This is how many states I have in the perturbative part of the spectrum. And basically, I don't want to have too many of them, okay? Otherwise, I won't be able to fit it with a supergravity-like description. So this is what I'd be calling the very sparse spectrum condition. So very good. So where are we? Okay, so imagine we have a space of conformal field theories, okay? One day, we'll be able to characterize fully the space of conformal field theories. Within that big space of conformal field theories, I want you to pay attention to what I will call, we'll carve out what we're interested in as holographers, is that we want to know what is the space of holographic CFTs, okay? And at this stage of what I said right now, I've imposed these conditions on what I'm calling a holographic CFT. I want them to have large central charge. I want them to capture the black hole entropy. And I want to have a perturbative regime where I have this very sparse condition.
Sorry, I didn't understand what is extended Cardi regime.
It's because I didn't explain it too much. But basically, so let me just write it here. So when you write down the Cardi formula, so this is the entropy. It's a 2 pi. So Cardi means that this is valid when E is much bigger than C. But what I call the extended Cardi regime, is when this is valid in this regime, when the energy is comparable to the central charge and both are bigger. Because this, if you use the dictionary of ADS3 CFT2, this is what maps to the area of the black hole being big in Planck units. So this regime, I didn't want it to go too much through that, but the Cardi regime is just energies, very, very large energies, regardless of the value of the central charge. In gravity, you want to have this large degeneracy of states when the energies are comparable to the central charges.
But is the Cardi formula still valid in that regime?
Generically, no. So that's why it's a restriction. That's why it's a necessary condition. It's very much tied. So condition one is tied to condition two. So if you have this perturbative regime, it will guarantee that you have an extended Cardi regime. So this is what was shown by studying the Hawking-Page transition and the spectrum of BPS states. So that's why I kind of didn't explain it, didn't go through this once, but this is basically implied by the very sparse condition. Oh, well, I should put it. So if I focus on this perturbative condition, then I will be guaranteed to have this extended Cardi regime. So very good. OK, so this is what I want. I want to understand the space of conformal field theories at large central charge. And basically, I need to have control on their spectrum. So I have to be capable of quantifying what are the states in this theory and make sure that I meet my criteria. So there's a simple way how you can, we don't know what the space of CFTs is, and we definitely don't know what the space of large central charge CFTs are. So here I have to put myself into a corner and basically say, okay, so what can you say about the space of theories that have large central charge? Okay, there's an easy way how you can construct a theory that has a very large central charge, and it's just by repeating the theory. Okay, so if you have like one scalar, then talk about two, or three, four, like, and then n scalars, and then take n to infinity. So this is what called basically building tensor products of the theory. So that's what this little symbol here basically denotes. So this is an easy way how you can increase the central charge, which basically counts the number of degrees of freedom, and you can just repeat the theory multiple times. That's what I'm trying to depict in this picture here. Now this will give you too many states. It's too dense, And so what people usually do to get rid of states and trying to achieve this light condition is that you mod out by the symmetric product. So basically by permutations of these copies. And this is what we call the symmetric product orbifold. So that's the second part of my title, basically was referring to studying conformal field theories for which the central charge is large because they come about this procedure. Okay? And these types of theories, when you describe them as build them out of a symmetric product orbifold, they're really interesting and they already have like nice properties. And one of them is that, so let's say that if this was the partition function for one theory, in the symmetric product contents, it's very natural to build a grand canonical ensemble where you're also averaging over theories. And so here, basically, for each value of m, so how many times I do this this tensor product procedure, I basically build, I introduce a chemical potential for it, and then I build basically a generating functional for the combination of theories. And this is quite nice as a way how to think about taking large C limits, because what I basically was advocating here is that the energy and the central charge are comparable. So I should be treating them both in some equal footing about how do you treat them in a thermodynamic sense. And so if I treat it actually as an ensemble, then this actually gives you a lot of mathematical control on how do you extract, how do you do the analytic continuation in central charges, okay? Otherwise, it feels a little bit awkward. How would you treat a parameter that is usually discrete as a continuous variable as you take the limit going to infinity? So this is what it's very nice about considering these classes of theories. Now, this is a little bit of a technical remark for the experts in the room. If I just stop here, I will be cheating. The talk will be over now. Because if I just tell you this about these theories, there's a problem. You can compute the spectrum based on what the seed was, the first one was, and they universally have a string theory-like growth of states. It's what people call Hagendorf growth of states. So it's not quite what you want to do. So you don't want to just study symmetric product orbifolds, but the lessons from the prior string theory constructions is that the symmetric product orbifold corresponds to a weakly coupled description of the string theory, but if you add a marginal deformation to that string theory spectrum, then you would go to the strongly coupled regime where you would have the supergravity description, and so basically we treat the symmetric product theories as theories for which we're going to add a marginal deformation and then try to get rid of all this Hagendorn-like stuff that I don't like. And in this context, this is where I'm going to restrict myself to supersymmetric quantities. So the reason why I'm going to only talk about supersymmetric quantities is because there will be quantities that are protected against these marginal deformations, okay? And so that tells me that even if I don't know what this marginal deformation is and how it makes me RG flow, if I look at supersymmetric quantities, they should already satisfy my criteria because they're protected. So if a supersymmetric quantity does not satisfy my conditions, then stop studying that symmetric product orbifold theory for the purposes of doing holography, okay? You're just done. Now, if the supersymmetric quantity does satisfy that condition, then you take the next step. It's like, okay, let's understand what is this marginal deformation, what's going on, how do we understand the theory for it, and understand other types of quantities that are not supersymmetric. Okay, so it's a first kind of criteria to basically get rid of a lot of things. So from that point of view, so since I'm going to now be in the land of supersymmetric things, there's the object that counts BPS states. It's called the elliptic genera. It's basically this object defined in the Ramon-Ramon sector of the theory. It's built mathematically. It's built out of a weak Jacobi form, and we'll be taking symmetric product orbifolds of basically this elliptic genera. And in this context, in the language of supersymmetric theories, what I want is basically to put a condition on the NS sector, on light states around the NS sector, that they satisfy my sparseness requirement. Okay, and so then again, we have to be careful that generically this number, if you don't say much about the theory, this number will be one for a symmetric product orbifolds. And so what we really want is to get this number to be less than one, and this will be imposing conditions even on these type of objects. And the spoiler is, if you don't want to pay attention anymore, is that by looking at these objects, we will find new examples, okay? And we can basically quantify it. Okay, so what is the picture?
Question. So now your stickers set to zero temperature then, because you mentioned supersymmetric black holes are just zero temperature.
Yeah. Yeah, they still satisfy this equation, and they're still like a left, like, so usually what happens, so again, because I'm being, in general, this guy has like two contributions, the left movers, the right movers. So supersymmetry basically kills one of them, and then you still have a large degeneracy. I'm basically looking at this part of the spectrum. So yeah. So where are we standing now? So this is what I decided to do. So we wanted to understand what are these holographic CFTs. For that, I needed to understand what is the space of large C CFTs. I don't know what that is. So I'm going to like carve another region of the space of conformal field theories, which are these symmetric product theories. And I'm basically, my question is, what is the intersection between these two things? Okay, so do they overlap? How much do they overlap? Can we quantify basically the overlap between these two thingies there? Okay, so let's understand the answer to that question, the landscape. Okay, so we had that. So we had this big generating functional for supersymmetric states, beautiful formula, and basically we're trying to require that there's very few states on the theory on the boundary that will be interpreted as perturbative states on the bulk. Okay, now, how do we go about solving this question? So we basically want to characterize this big object standing here. So this is what we do. So four papers to present you four steps. So roughly speaking, now there's many like knobs and stuff, but this is basically like very succinctly what's happening to you. So the way we proceed to trying to understand if a theory is good or not from this holographic point of view. So I'm doing this multiplication, this iteration of like theory. So I will pick one. So I pick the seed, okay? In the mathematics form, it means that I'm selecting a Jacobi form. So I'm picking one modular form. Then you will do the symmetric product, okay? So you will tensor product and quotient by the symmetric thing. Okay, great. Then the very nice insight that we had was that these generating functionals for these symmetric product theories were actually connected, very beautifully connected, to other modular forms in mathematics that go under the name of Siegel paramodular forms. These are forms that have an enhanced symmetry. If I have the time, I'll tell you a bit more about them. But the relationship of the symmetric product orbifolds to Siegel paramodular forms was actually what gave us a lot of control in understanding how do you extract information out of like this things that look like a horrendous beast. Now, once we know, so this is why it takes many papers, because this third point is quite elaborate. But in any case, I'll just tell you what the final answer is. And the point is that we can extract basically the Fourier coefficients. We can quantify the spectrum. And the answer that I'll be reporting to you is basically a functional where I already took the limit C going to infinity. Okay, so I'll tell you, like, if you take the strict C going to infinity limit, so you're really in the classical theory of gravity, how many states do you have? And basically, this is the object that needs to satisfy my very sparse condition. Okay? So this is where we are. So we have our very sparse condition on the NS sector, and we want to understand what are objects that satisfy that very sparse condition. The answer, this one. So basically, the only thing, I'm not going to prove this to you, but it's proven in the papers, is basically, so we selected a seed. So we selected one Jacobi form. It's characterized by what's known as an index and basically the maximal polarity term. And based on these two entries, we will be able to basically tell you if this thing is going to satisfy the sparseness condition or not.
A very silly question. Is y the imaginary part of z in these formulas, or is something else?
Y is e to the 2 pi z.
Okay. And q?
Yeah, and then q is e to the 2 pi I tau.
Okay.
and P, okay. If I write down rho, I know, I think I'm not writing rho. No, but okay. So Z is the fugacity associated to the U1 charge in your superconformal algebra. And then, yeah, and tau is the complex structure of the torus. Okay. Very good. So this is actually the fact that I can write the condition in one slide, and it's basically, it's just a maximization problem, makes it very easy to solve. And so if you ask me what are such promising examples of these holographic CFTs, they've actually been following you through the talk. So for those of those astute, there were like little things written on the sides, and those were all examples of holographic CFTs. But in any case, here's a horrible table that I basically tell you, like just to show it to you that we can systematically study the space of Jacobi forms and tell you which of them satisfy this very sparse condition. So here I'm basically reporting you select a value of T of the index and of this maximal polarity, and the third column is basically how many of those Jacobi forms satisfy our criteria. Now there's a lot of zeros, so you can see that the condition is non-trivial. So in many cases, there will be no examples, okay? And then one is a very typical number. So, and then maybe two, and then, okay, this one had four, which seems very special, but it's very, very low. So the condition is quite stringent, and the space of theories is non-trivial. I should also illustrate that if you just fix the index t, the space of Jacobi forms roughly grows like t squared. So that's where you can also appreciate that if you have 16 square, big number, much, much tinier than this ones, twos, and fours that I'm describing. Okay? So there are non-trivial examples. All of these numbers basically are non-trivial examples when you don't have a zero, but it is also as well a very stringent condition. So, and this is not difficult to implement. Now, what I should address today basically is like, well, you give me this table with all these numbers. Where's the physics? I got lost in the math. This is what we're working on right now. So now that we know what these Jacobi forms are, the question is, what is the CFT? So tell me more about like this fancy CFTs that you're building. What else do they share in common besides these properties on the Jacobi forms? And this is where really understanding the fundamental mechanism of ADS CFT goes into place. Now, there's two examples in this long list of numbers that we do know what's going on. Okay, so the one example where it's clear what's going on and it falls into, it's basically this first entry here. This is the famous example that led to the Snowman-Dravafa computations. It goes under the name of the D1-D5 system. But in any case, and the here I just presented some details of what these modular forms are. The Siegel pair modular form that I was discussing goes under the name of the Igusa-Kos form. And this is the case where we understand very well what the quarter BPS black holes represent in relationship to quarter BPS dions in N equal 4 string theory. The supergravity spectrum matches beautifully the one of the CFT. And there's also as well some others known as CHL generalizations that have been studied. Yes?
All of in this list that you have, you've chosen them so that we have a perturbative quantum gravity.
So we will grab all of them, and then I basically divide them into two. Okay. I divide them into the ones that meet my very sparse condition and the ones that don't.
Okay.
And I can make very clear that distinction and be like, so there's a space for each T, there's a ring of Jacobi form. There's like a basis of how many Jacobi forms you have for a fixed value of T. And then we select B just to organize things.
So you want to make a related to gravity, each of the ones.
Yeah, each of, exactly. Each of
you
the.
You're going to tell us what.
Tomorrow. Tomorrow. No, it was quite a lot of work to do.
Yes.
Okay. No, but this is the part that I'm saying that it's a work in progress. So we basically, the thing that was not known before, basically this example was known. It's like this was all, well, there was another, I'll show you another example, which is here. This this 4-2-2 was, it's the other, it's much more recent example that was also known. None of these other things were known in the context of string theory even. And so now, that's why it's a lot of work. So we have to either make choices. Okay, let's pick I can start picking entry by entry, but we're trying to understand kind of like what do all of them share together. So, and it's that's why. And then I need to learn way more about conformal field theories, which I'm trying. So it's yeah. But okay, in any case, yeah. So right now what we managed to do, what we did was to phrase the question. So we had a physics question that I started with this question of ADS3CFT2. We made it into a question about modular forms, about weak Jacobi forms. And so we managed to actually, using the strength of the modular properties of these forms, to tell you, like, look, this is what's happening. These are the theories. These will be the partition functions that will lead to interesting features. Yes?
While you're on this slide, do you know anything about the asymptotic behavior for T large?
For T large, no. So this is why.
Measure zero.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. But actually, yeah. So one of my collaborators, Christopher Keller, he's more of a mathematician than I am. So and he actually he's an expert on these Jacobi forms, and he was telling me that actually it's not clear how the T squared that I was advocating to. It's a very kind of a rough estimate of how many Jacobi forms you have. And the problem is the following, is that if you give me a value of T, like a mathematician, yes, will be able to tell you, you give me a value of T, this is the ring. Okay, and then they will construct it for you. But for, they don't know, my understanding from what Christoph teaches me is that it's not known what happens if you take T to be very large. And it's because these Jacobi forms are characterized by their polar coefficients, and there's a mismatch between the dimensionality of the space and the number of free polar coefficients. So rough estimates are being placed based on how many polar coefficients a given Jacobi form can have. But it's a bad, as T gets bigger and bigger, it's a worse and worse approximation to how many of these forms you have. And so, yeah. He's actually trying to understand if he can actually answer this mathematical like question. And that's why I can't tell you what happens to this landscape. Like, we can do it, like we can put it in a computer. And if I use fancy words like machine learning, it will tell me like something. Like, it will spell out like a number, like 67. Like, it's like, yeah, it's like, oh, that's the number. Okay, but yeah, but it's a... What is the number, like in the movie?
In Hitchhiker's Guide?
Yeah.
42.
Yeah, that. It will tell me, I'm sure. It will tell, I'll put it in a computer, it will tell me 42. And then we'll all be like, to understand that 42, it's very important. Okay, I have 5 minutes. So this was the other example, which is very nice. It's done by the set of authors. It's a little bit different in terms of the conformal field theory, which is interesting. It's also different from some mathematical properties of the seeds that we're using that I thought was quite fascinating. But in any case, these are two examples out of this long list where you can ask many questions and be like, oh, what is the string theory? What is the supergravity? What are the black hole? Like, what are like, and kind of see how things match and get your hands very dirty. Okay, so yeah, I was going to say a little bit about quantum black holes, but you told me I have like 2 minutes. Yeah, but that's always dangerous because in my head, 2 minutes, actually.
Wait until you get started, and at some point I might stop.
Yeah, just stop. Yeah, okay. In any case, it's not. This is. I promise it's pretty brief. But it's a little bit technical. That's why I'm a bit hesitant. But the point is that. So I mentioned that we were studying the Siegel pair modular forms. And we're basically extracting Fourier coefficients out of that Siegel pair modular form. So this is a function of three variables, and what makes it Siegel is that there's an exchange symmetry between two of the entries. So you have here rho, tau, and set. And so, sorry, rho. So P was the thing that told you that you were averaging over theories. Q is basically telling you something about the energy. And there's an exchange symmetry between tau and rho. This is quite a powerful symmetry. It's basically what allows us to do many of these computations precisely. But in the context of black hole entropy, this exchange symmetry basically tells you that you're going to get an extended Cardi regime for free. Because if the object that you're computing has an exchange symmetry between energy and central charges, then you can get around this basic requirements, because you can switch around the orders, and then you could have a Cardi regime when C is big and E is small. as well. So in any case, this is why a lot of these formulas in the string theory context work very well, and they describe the black hole entropy to a lot of accuracy. Now, something that I find interesting, so this is just the area law. It's very universal, very robust. But the thing that I find very interesting is actually understanding the corrections. So the area law is just the very first piece of the whole story. There's corrections. In particular here, I highlighted the logarithmic correction to the black hole entropy. This correction is actually sensitive to the theory. So depending on which modular form you give me, it will report on a different answer. And what I'm doing in this table is just to illustrate that depending on how you scale the parameters, the correction, so what I'm writing in this last table, is basically this number that appears in front of the log. And so if you're in the Cardi regime, the log only depends on the weight of the form. But if you're not in the Cardi regime, if you're in a regime that is actually more suitable for black holes, these numbers are different. And they're sensitive to the details of the theory. And this is where, for instance, Ashok Sen was very successful in matching a supergravity description. He computed the one-loop corrections, the logarithmic corrections to the black hole entropy in four dimensions. He basically did a supergravity computation, and they match very nicely for the Egusa-Kaas form. They might match very beautifully those corrections there. So it's quite non-trivial to get those corrections to match. So what needs to be explored here in this context, I think, is really understanding, okay, once we kind of got over the area law, it's like, what can we learn from actually doing the corrections, okay? So how are things fitting? So there's a lot of work in understanding how to do these computations and recording them from the gravitational point of view. And surprisingly, there's a lot of universality in these corrections in the sense of, like, generically, what appears in front of the log can be a complicated function of the parameters of the black hole. But when you embed them in supergravity, they tend to, like, boil down to be things that depend very minimally on the spectrum, which is quite beautiful. And it will be interesting to understand those kind of coincidences or cancellations that are happening. Now, the other thing that will be interesting to study, which these modular forms also capture, is how black holes, so if you have a supersymmetric black hole, even though it's supersymmetric or not, you can also split it. You can build multicenter, this is my last, basically. You can build multicenter configurations. And so understanding how, and these counting formulas counts everything. They count single center solutions, and they also count multicenter solutions. So from the mathematics point of view, this theory of Mach modular forms is what tells you how you can disentangle the contribution of a single black hole versus a multicenter black hole. And this will be very interesting to, as well, explore in the context of these new examples of counting formulas. So OK, so I'm done. So this is what happened to us. So I managed to say something about the orange. That's very good. So where are we right now? So we're looking at the space of conformal field theories. I was interested in these holographic CFTs. I decided to focus on the symmetric product orbifold theories. And today, I basically told you about what is the overlap between these two regions in the context of superconformal field theories. Tomorrow, let's understand why was I successful, okay? So what is the mechanism behind this, okay? So what is missing again? So I exploited math. Tomorrow, I'm going to exploit physics. So thank you.
Yeah, just to follow up on that question, do you expect that we'll get, so you're classifying these CFTs to possibly learn something also about perturbative quantum gravity?
Exactly, yes, because I want to understand then what are the features of the gravitational theory and what does it tell me about having a good UV description. So it will also impose restrictions on what combinations of perturbative fields you can have. And that, I think, is very interesting, like in sort of saying, like, oh, you can't just write down whatever effective field theory you want at low energies. There might be non-trivial restrictions on how which of those you can UV complete. Mm-hmm. And basically, yeah. So,
but you also expect to learn a little bit more about different kinds of black hole solutions, or are there just observations on existing black hole? So that's the part that I didn't quite understand.
Well, the BTC is kind of very, it's the king. Or queen.
Queen. Queen. Queen. Queen. Queen. Queen. Queen. Queen. Queen. Queen. Queen. Queen.
Well, as I said, in Spanish, it's male, unfortunately. Sorry, I was thinking. But yeah, the BTC is extremely robust. And so you could do other things, but they will never dominate. Like, this entropy is basically, like, at large energies. It's the BTC is just super dominant in that way. So, but we hope that one day I'll grow up to higher dimensions and then trying to understand, okay, how can you implement these things in higher dimensional theories of gravity, and like, so what are the lessons that we're learning here? Yeah.
I mean, you got quite a list of possible dual theories.
Yeah.
And this was like one construction principle that could be even more out there. So are you happy or unhappy that you got quite a large list of?
Well, it depends. The large depends on, like, because the sizes are not very meaningful. So the large depends on, like, if I understood what the space of theory is, then I would have a better understanding. But from the, even from the point of view of Jacobi forms, they're very few. So it's just interesting that I got more than what was known. So from that point of view, it's large because the table looks impressive, right? Because I wrote all these numbers there. But yeah.
Also, from my point, you know, you hope to get a unique answer at some point.
Well, I think there will be different UV completions to gravity. So I don't, because at least from a string theory point of view, we know that there's different compactifications that give us an ADS3 factor. So, but I do want to understand, why is it that it works? Like, why would I have, like, these isolated examples? So what is, like, what is it that I haven't learned from, like, doing my string compactifications or understanding the low energy physics? What is it that I'm missing in order to appreciate why I got these isolated points? Because what the table illustrates is that they're there, but they're not, like, so common. They're kind of rare. So I want to understand the rarity in that. Well, this is worth, yeah, so alluvial, it's a bit, so this is where CFT2s are tricky, because they do have a lot of things that they all share in common, because the Virasoro symmetry is very powerful. So, but alluvial by itself, as it stands, as I understand it, if you just give me alluvial theory, is not dual to what I, it might be dual to something, but it will not be dual to gravity. By gravity, I mean Einstein-Hilbert plus a cosmological constant. There's a continuous part of the spectrum that I don't see. Like, if when we went through the universal parts, I just don't have any part of the spectrum that is continuous. So, and it's hard. There's also problems with the vacuum state in alluvial and how it relates to vacuum ADS. And so, like, Steve here, for instance, have beautiful reviews where he explains these things very clearly. And so, despite the fact that alluvial still has, like, these type of formulas, as Steve has papers on this, you have to be careful about how you interpret them and, like, actually, how do you actually use modular symmetry to get to them. Now, it tends to be that alluvial is a theory where you can easily take a large C limit, and then you can do a lot of, like, what people call, like, bootstrap type techniques. Like, you can extract conformal blocks by studying alluvial theory, because a conformal block doesn't care about the theory. So people tend to use a lot alluvial as just an artifact to understand something about basic building blocks of CFTs. But from the perspectives of what I wanted a CFT to be holographic, alluvial doesn't meet my criteria. So it might be dual to some strange theory of gravity, and that might be fine. But not to what I would have called, like, semi-classical, like a perturbative theory of gravity. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, so before we close for lunch, let me on behalf of the organizers reiterate the invitation to please all come to the colloquium, and in particular also to the discussion afterwards in the Sky Room starting at 4 p.m. So let's thank our speaker.